asked. "Not that I don't enjoy the scenery," I added, blushing despite myself. "I think I like the beard." "Maybe," I added doubtfully, scrutinising him.
"I don't," he said frankly, scratching his jaw. "I'm crawling wi' lice, and it itches like a fiend."
"Ew!" While I was entirely familiar with Pediculus humanus, the common body louse, acquaintance had not endeared me. I rubbed a hand nervously through my own hair, already imagining the prickle of feet on my scalp as tiny cestets gambolled through the thickets of my curls. He grinned at me, white teeth startling in the auburn beard.
"Dinna fash yourself, Sassenach," he assured me. "I've already sent for a razor and hot water."
"Really? Seems rather a pity to shave it off right away." Despite the lice, I leaned forward to peer at his hirsute adornment. "It's like your hair, all different colours. Rather pretty, really." I touched it warily. The hairs were odd, thick and wiry, very curly, in contrast to the soft, thick smoothness of the hair on his head. They sprang exuberantly from his skin in a profusion of colours, copper, gold, amber, cinnamon, a roan so deep as almost to be black. Most startling of all was a thick streak of silver that ran from his lower lip to the line of his jaw. "That's funny," I said, tracing it. "You haven't any white hairs on your head, but you have right here."
"I have."
He put a hand to his jaw, looking startled, and I suddenly realised that he likely had no idea what he looked like. Then he smiled wryly and bent to pick up the pile of discarded clothes from the floor.
"Aye, well, little wonder if I have. I wonder I've not gone white-haired altogether from the things I've been through this month."
He paused, eyeing me over the wadded white breeches.
"And speaking of that, Sassenach, as I was saying to you in the trees..."
"Yes, speaking of that," I interrupted. "What in the name of God did you do?"
"Oh, the soldiers, you mean?"
He scratched his chin meditatively.
"Well, it was simple enough. I told the soldiers that as soon as the ship was launched, we'd gather everyone on deck, and at my signal, they were to fall on the crew and push them into the hold."
A broad grin blossomed through the foliage. "Only Fergus had mentioned it to the crew, you see. So when each soldier came aboard, two of the crewmen snatched him by the arms while a third gagged him, bound his arms and took away his weapons. Then we pushed all of them into the hold. That's all." He shrugged, modestly nonchalant.
"Right," I said, exhaling.
"And as for just how you happened to be here in the first place..." At this juncture, we were interrupted by a discreet knock on the cabin's door.
"Mr. Fraser? Captain, I mean."
Maitland's angular young face peered round the jamb, cautious over a steaming bowl.
"Mr. Murphy's got the galley fire going, and here's your hot water with his compliments."
"Mr. Fraser will do," Jamie assured him, taking the tray with bowl and razor in one hand.
"A less seaworthy captain doesn't bear thinking of."
He paused, listening to the thump of feet above our heads.
"Though, since I am the captain," he said slowly, "I suppose that means I shall see when we sail and when we stop."
"Yes, sir. That's one thing a captain does," Maitland said. He added helpfully, "A captain also says when the hands are to have extra rations of food and grog."
"I see."
The upward curl of Jamie's mouth was still visible, beard notwithstanding.
"Tell me, Maitland, how much do you think the hands can drink and still sail the ship?"
"Oh, quite a lot, sir," Maitland said earnestly. His brow wrinkled in thought. "Maybe an extra double ration all round?" Jamie lifted one eyebrow.
"Of brandy?"
"Oh, no, sir." Maitland looked shocked. "Grog, if it was to be brandy, only an extra half ration, or he'd be rolling in the bilges."
"Double grog, then."
Jamie bowed ceremoniously to Maitland, unhampered by the fact that he was still completely unclad.
"Make it so, Mr. Maitland, and the ship will not lift anchor until I've finished my supper."
"Yes, sir."
And shall I desire the Chinee to attend you directly after the anchor is weighed?
Somewhat before that, Mr. Maitland, thank you kindly.
Maitland was turning to leave with a last admiring glance at Jamie's scars, but I stopped him.
One more thing, Maitland, I said.
Oh, yes, mum.
Will you go down to the galley and ask Mr. Murphy to send up a bottle of his strongest vinegar, and then find where the men have put some of my medicines and fetch them as well?
His narrow forehead creased in puzzlement, but he nodded obligingly.
Oh, yes, mum. This directly minute.
Just what do you mean to do with the vinegar, Sassenach?
Jamie observed me narrowly as Maitland vanished into the corridor.
Souse you in it to kill the lice, I said. I don't intend to sleep with a seething nest of vermin.
Oh, he said. He scratched the side of his neck meditatively.
You mean to sleep with me, do you?
He glanced at the berth, an uninviting hole in the wall.
I don't know where precisely, but yes, I do, I said firmly. And I wish you wouldn't shave your beard just yet, I added, as he bent to set down the tray he was holding.
Why not?
He glanced curiously over his shoulder at me, and I felt the heat rising in my cheeks.
Well, it's a bit different.
Why?
He stood up and took a step toward me. In the cramped confines of the cabin, he seemed even bigger, and a lot more naked than he ever had on deck. The dark blue eyes had slanted into triangles of amusement.
How different? He asked.
Well, it,
I brushed my fingers vaguely past my burning cheeks.
It feels different. When you kiss me. On my skin.
His eyes locked on mine. He hadn't moved, but he seemed much closer.
You have very fine skin, Sassenach, he said softly, like pearls and opals.
He reached out a finger and very gently traced the line of my jaw, and then my neck, and the wide flare of collarbone and back, and down, in a slow-moving serpentine that brushed the tops of my breasts, hidden in the deep cowl neck of the priest's robe.
You have a lot of very fine skin, Sassenach, he added.
One eyebrow quirked up.
If that's what you were thinking.
I swallowed and licked my lips, but didn't look away.
That's more or less what I was thinking, yes.
He took his finger away and glanced at the bowl of steaming water.
Aye, well, it seems a shame to waste the water. Shall I send it back to Murphy to make soup, or shall I drink it?
I laughed, both tension and strangeness dissolving at once.
You shall sit down, I said, and wash with it. You smell like a brothel.
I expect I do,
he said, scratching.
There's one upstairs in the tavern where the soldiers go to drink and gamble.
He took up the soap and dropped it in the hot water.
Upstairs, eh? I said.
Well, the girls come down between times, he explained. It wouldn't have been mannerly to stop them sitting on your lap, after all.
And your mother brought you up to have nice manners, I expect, I said, very dryly.
Upon second thoughts, I think perhaps we shall anchor here for the night, he said thoughtfully, looking at me.
Shall we?
And sleep ashore, where there's room.
Room for what? I asked, regarding him with suspicion.
Well, I have it planned, aye, he said, sloshing water over his face with both hands.
You have what planned? I asked.
He snorted and shook the excess water from his beard before replying.
I've been thinking of this for months now, he said with keen anticipation. Every night folded up in that godforsaken nutshell of a berth, listening to Fergus grunt and fart across the cabin. I thought it all out, just what I would do. Did I have ye naked and willing, no one in hearing and room enough to serve ye suitably?
He lathered the cake of soap vigorously between his palms and applied it to his face.
Well, I'm willing enough, I said, intrigued. And there's room, certainly.
As for naked,
I'll see to that,
he assured me.
That's part of the plan, eh? I shall take you to a private spot, spread out a quilt to lie on, and commence by sitting down beside you.
Well, that's a start, all right, I said.
What then?
I sat down next to him on the bath. He leaned close and bit my earlobe very delicately.
As for what next? Then I shall take you on my knee and kiss you.
He paused to illustrate, holding my arm so I couldn't move. He let go a minute later, leaving my lips slightly swollen, tasting of ale, soap, and Jamie.
So much for step one, I said, wiping soap suds from my mouth.
What then? Then I shall lay you down upon the quilt, twist your hair up in my hand, and taste your face and throat and ears and bosom with my lips, he said. I thought I would do that until you start to make squeaking noises.
I don't make squeaking noises.
Aye, you do, he said. Here, hand me the towel, aye.
There,
he went on cheerfully.
I thought I would begin at the other end. I shall lift up your skirt and...
His face disappeared into the folds of the linen towel.
And what?
I asked, thoroughly intrigued.
And kiss the insides of your thighs where the skin's so soft.
The beard might help there, aye?
He stroked his jaw, considering.
It might, I said, a little faintly. What am I supposed to be doing while you do this?
Well, you might moan a bit if you like, to encourage me. But otherwise, you just lie still.
He didn't sound as though he needed any encouragement whatever. One of his hands was resting on my thigh as he used the other to swab his chest with a damp towel. As he finished, the hand slid behind me and squeezed. "My beloved's arm is under me," I quoted, "and his hand behind my head. Comfort me with apples and stay me with flagons, for I am sick of love."
There was a flash of white teeth in his beard.
"More like grapefruit," he said,
one hand cupping my behind.
"Or possibly gourds. Grapefruit are too small."
"Gourds?"
I said indignantly.
"Well, wild gourds get that big sometimes," he said. "But I, that's next."
He squeezed once more, then removed the hand in order to wash the armpit on that side.
"I lie upon my back and have ye stretched at length upon me so that I can get hold of your buttocks and fondle them properly."
He stopped washing to give me a quick example of what he thought proper, and I let out an involuntary gasp.
"No,"
he went on, resuming his ablutions. "Should you wish to kick your legs a bit, or make lewd motions with your hips and pant in my ear at that point in the proceedings, I should have no great objection."
"I do not pant."
"Aye, you do. Now, about your breasts."
"Oh, I thought you'd forgotten those."
"Never in life,"
he assured me.
"No,"
he went blithely on.
"That's when I take off your gown, leaving you in naught but your shift."
"I'm not wearing a shift."
"Oh, well, that's no matter," he said, dismissing this. "I meant to suckle you through the thin cotton till your nipples stood up hard in my mouth and then take it off. But it's no great concern. I'll manage without. So, allowing for the absence of your shift, I shall attend to your breasts until you make that wee bleating noise."
"I don't."
"And then," he said, interrupting, "since you will, according to the plan, be naked, and provided I've done it right so far, possibly willing as well."
"Oh, just possibly," I said.
My lips were still tingling from step one.
"Then I shall spread open your thighs, take down my breeks."
And he paused, waiting.
"And?"
I said obligingly. The grin widened substantially.
"And we'll see what sort of noise it is you don't make then, Sassenach."
There was a slight cough in the doorway behind me.
"Oh, your pardon, Mr. Willoughby," Jamie said apologetically. "I wasn't expecting you so soon. Perhaps you'd care to go and have a bit of supper. And if you would, take those things along and ask Murphy will he burn them in the galley fire."
He tossed the remains of his uniform to Mr. Willoughby and bent to rummage in a sea locker for fresh clothing.
"I never thought to meet Lawrence Stern again," he remarked, burrowing through the tangled linen. "How does he come to be here?"
"Oh, he is the Jewish natural philosopher you told me about."
"He is. Though I shouldn't think there are so many Jewish philosophers about as to cause great confusion."
I explained how I had come to meet Stern in the mangroves.
"And then he brought me up to the priest's house," I said, and stopped, suddenly reminded. "Oh, I almost forgot. You owe the priest £2 sterling on account of Arabella."
"I do?"
Jamie glanced at me, startled, a shirt in his hand. "You do. Maybe you'd best ask Lawrence if he'll act as ambassador. The priest seems to get on with him."
"All right. What's happened to this Arabella, though? Has one of the crew debauched her?"
"I suppose you might say that."
I drew breath to explain further, but before I could speak, another knock sounded on the door.
"Can a man not dress in peace?" Jamie demanded irritably. "Come in, then."
The door swung open, revealing Massali, who blinked at the sight of her nude stepfather. Jamie hastily swathed his midsection in the shirt he was holding and nodded to her, sang froid, only slightly impaired.
"Massali, lass, I'm glad to see you unhurt. Did you require something?"
The girl edged into the room, taking up a position between the table and a sea chest.
I do," she said.
She was sunburned and her nose was peeling, but I thought she seemed pale nonetheless. Her fists were clenched at her sides and her chin lifted as for battle.
"I require you to keep your promise," she said.
"Aye?"
Jamie looked wary.
"You promised to let me and Fergus be married so soon as we came to the Indies?"
A small wrinkle appeared between her fair eyebrows.
"Hispaniola is in the Indies, no? The Jew said so."
Jamie scratched at his beard, looking reluctant.
"It is," he said. "And I suppose if I... Well, I did promise. But you're still sure of yourselves, the two of you?"
She lifted her chin higher, jaw set firmly.
"We are."
Jamie lifted one eyebrow.
"Where's Fergus?"
"Helping store the cargo. I kent we'd be underway soon, so I thought I'd best come and ask now."
"Aye, well."
Jamie frowned, then sighed with resignation.
"Aye," I said. "But I did say as you must be blessed by a priest, did I know? There's no priest closer than Bayamo, and that's 3 days' ride. But perhaps in Jamaica..."
"Nay, you're forgetting," Massali said triumphantly. "We've a priest right here. Father Fogden can marry us."
I felt my jaw drop and hastily closed it. Jamie was scowling at her.
"Was that sail first thing in the morning?"
"It won't take long," she said. "It's only a few words after all. We're already married by law. It's only to be blessed by the church, aye."
Her hand flattened on her abdomen, where her marriage contract presumably resided beneath her stays.
"But your mother?"
Jamie glanced helplessly at me for reinforcement. I shrugged, equally helpless. The task of trying either to explain Father Fogden to Jamie or to dissuade Massali was well beyond me.
"He likely won't do it, though."
Jamie came up with this objection with a palpable air of relief.
"The crew have been trifling with one of his parishioners named Arabella. He will not want anything to do with us, I'm afraid."
"Yes, he will. He'll do it for me. He likes me."
Massali was almost dancing on her toes with eagerness. Jamie looked at her for a long moment, eyes fixed on hers, reading her face. She was very young.
"You're sure then, lassie?"
he said at last, very gently.
"You want this?"
She took a deep breath, a glow spreading over her face. I am, da. I truly am. I want Fergus. I love him.
Jamie hesitated a moment, then rubbed a hand through his hair and nodded.
Aye, then. Go and send Mr. Stern to me, then fetch Fergus and tell him to make ready.
Oh, da, thank you, thank you.
Massali flung herself at him and kissed him. He held her with one arm, clutching the shirt about his middle with the other. Then he kissed her on the forehead and pushed her gently away.
Take care, he said, smiling. You didn't want to go to your bridal covered with lice.
Oh!
This seemed to remind her of something. She glanced at me and blushed, putting up a hand to her own pale locks, which were matted with sweat, and straggling down her neck from a careless knot.
Mother Clare, she said shyly, I wonder, would you... Could you lend me a bit of the special soap you make with a chamomile? I... If there's time, she added with a hasty glance at Jamie, I should like to wash my hair.
Of course, I said, and smiled at her. Come along and we'll make you pretty for your wedding. I looked her over appraisingly, from glowing round face to dirty bare feet. The crumpled muslin of her sea-shrunk gown stretched tight over her bosom, slight as it was, and the grubby hem hovered several inches above her sandy ankles. A thought struck me, and I turned to Jamie. She should have a nice dress to be married in, I said.
Sassenach, he said, with obviously waning patience. We haven't a...
No, but the priest does, I interrupted.
Tell Lawrence to ask Father Fogden whether we might borrow one of his gowns. Ermina Hilda's, I mean. I think they're almost the right size.
Jamie's face went blank with surprise above his beard.
Ermina Hilda, he said. Arabella. Gowns.
He narrowed his eyes at me.
What sort of priest is this man, Sassenach?
I paused in the doorway, Massali hovering impatiently in the passage beyond. Well, I said, he drinks a bit, and he's rather fond of sheep, but he might remember the words to the wedding ceremony. It was one of the more unusual weddings I had attended. The sun had long since sunk into the sea by the time all arrangements were made. To the disgruntlement of Mr. Warren, the ship's master, Jamie had declared that we wouldn't leave until the next day, so as to allow the newlyweds one night of privacy ashore.
"Damned if I'd care to consummate a marriage in one of those godforsaken pest-hole berths," he told me privately. "If they got coupled in there to start with, we'd never pry them out. Have the thought of taking a maidenhead in a hammock?"
"Quite," I said. I poured more vinegar on his head, smiling to myself. "Very thoughtful of you." Now Jamie stood by me on the beach, smelling rather strongly of vinegar, but handsome and dignified in blue coat, clean stock and linen, and grey serge breeks with his hair clubbed back and ribboned. The wild red beard was a bit incongruous above his otherwise sober garb, but it had been neatly trimmed and fine-combed with vinegar, and stocking feet notwithstanding, he made a fine picture as father of the bride. Murphy, as one chief witness, and Maitland as the other, were somewhat less prepossessing, though Murphy had washed his hands and Maitland his face. Fergus would have preferred Lawrence Stern as a witness, and Massali had asked for me, but both were dissuaded, first on grounds that Stern was not a Christian, let alone a Catholic, and then by consideration that while I was religiously qualified, that fact was unlikely to weigh heavily with Lyra once she found out about it.
"I've told Massali she must write to her mother to say she's wed," Jamie murmured to me as we watched the preparations on the beach go forward. "But perhaps I shall suggest she doesn't say much more about it than that."
I saw his point. Lyra was not going to be pleased at hearing that her eldest daughter had eloped with a one-handed ex-pickpocket twice her age. Her maternal feelings were unlikely to be assuaged by hearing that the marriage had been performed in the middle of the night on a West Indian beach by a disgraced, if not actually defrocked, priest, witnessed by 25 seamen, 10 French horses, a small flock of sheep,
all gaily beribboned in honour of the occasion, and a King Charles Spaniel, who added to the generally festive feeling by attempting to copulate with Murphy's wooden leg at every opportunity. The only thing that could make things worse, in Lyra's view, would be to hear that I had participated in the ceremony. Several torches were lit, bound to stakes pounded into the sand, and the flames streamed seaward in tails of red and orange, bright against the black velvet night. The brilliant stars of the Caribbean shone overhead like the lights of heaven. While it wasn't a church, few brides had had a more beautiful setting for their nuptials. I didn't know what prodigies of persuasion had been required on Lawrence's part, but Father Fogden was there, frail and insubstantial as a ghost, the blue sparks of his eyes the only real signs of life. His skin was grey as his robe, and his hands trembled on the worn leather of his prayer book. Jamie glanced sharply at him, and appeared to be about to say something, but then merely muttered under his breath in Gaelic, and pressed his lips tightly together. The spicy scent of sangria wafted from Father Fogden's vicinity, but at least he had reached the beach under his own power. He stood swaying between two torches, laboriously trying to turn the pages of his book, as the light offshore wind jerked them fluttering from his fingers. At last he gave up, and dropped the book on the sand with a little plop. He said, and belched. He looked about and gave us a small saint-like smile. "Dearly beloved of God!" It was several moments before the throng of shuffling, murmuring spectators realised that the ceremony had started, and began to poke each other and straighten to attention.
"Wilt thou take this woman?"
Father Fogden demanded, suddenly rounding ferociously on Murphy.
"No," said the cook, startled. "I don't hold wi' women. Messy things." "You don't?"
Father Fogden closed one eye, the remaining orb bright and accusing. He looked at Maitland.
"Do you take this woman?" "Not me, sir, no. Not that anyone wouldn't be pleased," he added hastily. "Him, please."
Maitland pointed at Fergus, who stood next to the cabin boy, glowering at the priest.
"Him? Sure. He hasn't a hand," Father Fogden said doubtfully. "Won't she mind?"
"I will not." Massali, imperious in one of Ermine Hilda's gowns, blue silk encrusted with gold embroidery along the low square neckline and puffed sleeves, stood beside Fergus. She looked lovely, with her hair clean and bright as fresh straw, brushed to a gloss, and floating loose round her shoulders, as became a maiden. She also looked angry.
"Go on!"
She stamped her foot, which made no noise on the sand, but seemed to startle the priest.
"Oh, yes," he said nervously, taking one step back. "Well, I don't suppose it's an impediment, after all. Not as though he's lost his cock, I mean. He hasn't, has he?"
the priest inquired anxiously, as the possibility occurred to him.
"I can't marry you if he has. It's not allowed."
Masali's face was already bathed in red by torchlight. The expression on it at this point reminded me strongly of how her mother had looked upon finding me at Lallybroch. A visible tremor ran through Fergus's shoulders, whether of rage or laughter, I couldn't tell. Jamie quelled the incipient riot by striding firmly into the middle of the wedding and placing a hand on the shoulders of Fergus and Massali. "This man," he said, with a nod toward Fergus, "and this woman," with another toward Massali.
"Marry them, father. Now.
Please," he added, as an obvious afterthought, and stood back a pace, restoring order among the audience by dint of dark glances from side to side.
"Oh, quite. Quite,"
Father Fogden repeated, swaying gently.
"Quite, quite."
A long pause followed, during which the priest squinted at Massali.
"Name," he said abruptly. "I have to have a name. Can't get married without a name. Just like a cock. Can't get married without a name. Can't get married without a..."
"Massali Jean McKimmy Joyce," Missali spoke up loudly, drowning him out.
"Yes, yes," he said hurriedly. "Of course it is. Missali.
Missali.
Just so. Well, then, do you,
Missali, take this man, even though he's missing a hand and possibly other parts not visible, to be your lawful husband, to have and to hold from this day forward, forsaking..."
At this point he trailed off, his attention fixed on one of the sheep that had wandered into the light and was chewing industriously on a discarded stocking of striped wool.
"I do!"
Father Fogden blinked, brought back to attention. He made an unsuccessful attempt to stifle another belch, and transferred his bright blue gaze to Fergus.
"You have a name, too, and a cock."
"Yes," said Fergus, wisely choosing not to be more specific.
"Fergus."
The priest frowned slightly at this.
"Fergus," he said. "Fergus. Fergus, yes, Fergus. Got that. That's all. No more names. Need more names, surely."
"Fergus," Fergus repeated, with a note of strain in his voice. Fergus was the only name he had ever had, bar his original French name of Claudel. Jamie had given him the name Fergus in Paris when they had met 20 years before. But naturally, a brothel-born bastard would have no last name to give a wife.
"Fraser," said a deep, sure voice beside me.
Fergus and Missali both glanced back in surprise, and Jamie nodded. His eyes met Fergus's, and he smiled faintly.
"Fergus Claudel Fraser," he said slowly and clearly.
One eyebrow lifted as he looked at Fergus. Fergus himself looked transfixed. His mouth hung open, eyes wide black pools in the dim light. Then he nodded slightly, and a glow rose in his face as though he contained a candle that had just been lit.
"Fraser," he said to the priest.
His voice was husky, and he cleared his throat.
"Fergus Claudel Fraser."
Father Fogden had his head tilted back, watching the sky, where a crescent of light floated over the trees, holding the black orb of the moon in its cup. He lowered his head to face Fergus, looking dreamy.
"Well, that's good," he said, "isn't it?"
A small poke in the ribs from Maitland brought him back to an awareness of his responsibilities.
Well, man and wife. Yes, I pronounce you man... No, that's not right. You haven't said whether you take her. She has both hands," he added helpfully.
"I will,"
Fergus said. He had been holding Missali's hand. Now he let go and dug hastily in his pocket, coming out with a small gold ring. He must have bought it in Scotland, I realized, and kept it ever since, not wanting to make the marriage official until it had been blessed. Not by a priest, by Jamie. The beach was silent as he slid the ring on her finger, all eyes fixed on the small gold circle and the two heads bent close together over it, one bright, one dark. So, she had done it. One 15-year-old girl with nothing but stubbornness as a weapon. "I want him," she had said, and kept saying it, through her mother's objections and Jamie's arguments, through Fergus's scruples and her own fears, through 3,000 miles of homesickness, hardship, ocean storm, and shipwreck. She raised her face, shining, and found her mirror in Fergus's eyes. I saw them look at each other and felt the tears prickle behind my lids.
"I want him."
I hadn't said that to Jamie at our marriage. I hadn't wanted him then. But I had said it since, 3 times, in 2 moments of choice at Craignadun, and once again at Lallybroch.
"I want him."
I wanted him still, and nothing whatever could stand between us. He was looking down at me. I could feel the weight of his gaze, dark blue and tender as the sea at dawn.
"What are you thinking, Mukria?"
he asked softly. I blinked back the tears and smiled at him. His hands were large and warm on mine.
"What I tell you three times is true," I said.
And standing on tiptoe, I kissed him as the sailor's cheer went up. Part 9. Worlds Unknown. Chapter 53. Bat Guano.
Bat guano is a slimy blackish green when fresh, a powdery light brown when dried. In both states, it emits an eye-watering reek of musk, ammonia and decay. "How much of this stuff did you say we're taking?" I asked through the cloth I'd wrapped about my lower face.
10 tons, Jamie replied,
his words similarly muffled. We were standing on the upper deck, watching as the slaves trundled barrow-loads of the reeking stuff down the gangplank and over to the open hatchway of the afterhold. Tiny particles of the dried guano blew from the barrows and filled the air around us with a deceptively beautiful cloud of gold that sparked and glimmered in the late afternoon sun. The men's bodies were coated with the stuff as well. The runnels of sweat carved dark channels in the dust on their bare torsos, and the constant tears ran down their faces and chests so that they were striped in black and gold like exotic zebras. Jamie dabbed at his own streaming eyes as the wind veered slightly toward us.
"Do you care how to keelhaul someone, Sassenach?"
"No, but if it's Fergus you have in mind as a candidate, I'm with you."
"How far is it to Jamaica?"
It was Fergus, making inquiries in the marketplace on King's Street in Bridgetown, who had gained the Artemis her first commission as a trading and hauling vessel, the shipment of 10 cubic tons of bat guano from Barbados to Jamaica, for use as fertilizer on the sugar plantation of one Mr. Gray, planter. Fergus himself was rather self-consciously overseeing the loading of the huge quarried blocks of dried guano which were tipped from their barrows and handed down one by one into the hold. Masali, never far from his side, had in this case moved as far as the forecastle, where she sat on a barrel filled with oranges, the lovely new shawl Fergus had bought her in the market wrapped over her face.
"We are meant to be traders, no?" Fergus had argued. "We have an empty hold to fill. Besides," he had added logically, clinching the argument, "Monsieur Gray will pay us more than adequately." "How far, Sassenach?"
Jamie squinted at the horizon as though hoping to see land rising from the sparkling waves. Mr. Willoughby's magic needles rendered him seaworthy, but he submitted to the process with no real enthusiasm.
3 or 4 days' sail, Warren says," he admitted with a sigh,
"and the weather holds fair."
"Maybe the smell will be better at sea," I said.
"Oh, yes, me lady,"
Fergus assured me, overhearing as he passed.
"The owner tells me that the stench dissipates itself significantly once the dried material is removed from the caves where it accumulates."
He leapt into the rigging and went up, climbing like a monkey despite his hook. Reaching the top rigging, Fergus tied the red kerchief that was the signal to hands on shore to come aboard, and slid down again, pausing to say something rude to Ping Ong, who was perched on the lowest cross-trees, keeping a bright yellow eye on the proceedings below.
"Fergus seems to be taking quite a proprietary interest in this cargo," I observed.
"Aye, well, he's a partner," Jamie said. "I told him if he'd a wife to support, he must think of how to do it. And as it may be some time before we're in the printing business again, he must turn his hand to what offers. He and Marsali have half the profit on this cargo, against the dowry I promised her," he added wryly,
and I laughed.
"You know," I said, "I really would like to read the letter Marsali's sending to her mother. First Fergus, I mean, then Father Fogden and Mama Sita, and now a dowry of 10 tons of batshit."
"I shall never be able to set foot in Scotland again once Lyra reads it," said Jamie,
but he smiled nonetheless.
"Have you thought yet what to do with your new acquisition?"
"Don't remind me," I said a little grimly. "Where is he?"
"Somewhere below," Jamie said,
his attention distracted by a man coming down the wharf towards us.
"Murphy's fed him, and Innes will find a place for him. Your pardon, Sassenach. I think this will be someone looking for me.
He swung down from the rail and went down the gangplank, neatly skipping around a slave coming up with a barrowload of guano.
I watched with interest as he greeted the man, a tall colonial in the dress of a prosperous planter with a weathered red face that spoke of long years in the islands. He extended a hand toward Jamie, who took it in a firm clasp. Jamie said something, and the man replied, his expression of wariness changing to an instant cordiality.
This must be the result of Jamie's visit to the Masonic Lodge in Bridgetown, where he had gone immediately upon landing the day before, mindful of Jared's suggestion. He had identified himself as a member of the Brotherhood and spoken to the master of the lodge, describing young Ian and asking for any news of either the boy or the ship Brucha. The master had promised to spread the word among such Freemasons as might have occasion to frequent the slave market and the shipping docks. With luck, this was the fruit of that promise.
I watched eagerly as the planter reached into his coat and withdrew a paper which he unfolded and showed to Jamie, apparently explaining something. Jamie's face was intent, his ruddy brows drawn together with concentration, but showed neither exultation nor disappointment.
Maybe it wasn't news of Ian at all.
After our visit to the slave market the day before, I was half inclined to hope not.
Lawrence, Fergus, Marsali, and I had gone to the slave market under the cranky chaperonage of Murphy while Jamie called on the Masonic master. The slave market was near the docks, down a dusty road lined with cellars of fruit and coffee, dried fish and coconuts, yams and red cochineal bugs sold for dye in small corked glass bottles. Murphy, with his passion for order and propriety, had insisted that Masali and I must each have a parasol, and had forced Fergus to buy two from a roadside vendor.
"All the white women in Bridgetown carry parasols," he said firmly, trying to hand me one.
"I don't need a parasol," I said, impatient at talk of something so inconsequential as my complexion, when we might be near to finding Ian at last. "The sun isn't that hot. Let's go."
Murphy glowered at me, scandalized.
"You don't want folk to think you ain't respectable, that you don't care enough to keep your skin fine."
"I wasn't planning to take up residence here," I said tartly. "I don't care what they think."
Not pausing to argue further, I began walking down the road toward a distant murmur of noise that I took to be the slave market.
"Your face will get red," Murphy said, huffing indignantly alongside me, attempting to open the parasol as he stumped along.
"Oh, a fate worse than death, I'm sure," I snapped.
My nerves were strung tight in anticipation of what we might find.
"Oh, all right then, give me the bloody thing."
I snatched it from him, snapped it open, and set it over my shoulder with an irritable twirl. As it was, within minutes I was grateful for Murphy's intransigence. While the road was shaded by tall palms and cecropia trees, the slave market itself was held in a large stone-paved space without the grace of any shade, save that provided by ramshackle open booths roofed with sheets of tin or palm fronds, in which the slave dealers and auctioneers sought occasional refuge from the sun. The slaves themselves were mostly held in large pens at the side of the square, open to the elements. The sun was fierce in the open, and the light bouncing off the pale stones was blinding after the green shade of the road. I blinked, eyes watering, and hastily adjusted my parasol over my head. So shaded, I could see a bewildering array of bodies, naked or nearly so, gleaming in every shade from pale café au lait to a deep blue-black. Bouquets of colour blossomed in front of the auction blocks, where the plantation owners and their servants gathered to inspect the wares, vivid amid the stark blacks and whites. The stink of the place was staggering, even to one accustomed to the stenches of Edinburgh and the reeking tween decks of the porpoise. Heaps of wet human excrement lay in the corners of the slave pens, buzzing with flies, and a thick oily reek floated on the air. But the major component of the smell was the unpleasantly intimate scent of acres of hot bare flesh baking in the sun.
"Jesu,"
Fergus muttered next to me. His dark eyes flickered right and left in shocked disapproval.
It's worse than the slums in Montmartre.
Massali didn't say a word, but drew closer to his side, her nostrils pinched. Lawrence was more matter-of-fact. I supposed he must have seen slave markets before, during his exploration of the islands.
The whites are at that end, he said,
gesturing toward the far side of the square.
Come, we'll ask for news of any young men sold recently.
He placed a large square hand in the centre of my back and urged me gently forward through the crowd. Near the edge of the market, an old black woman squatted on the ground, feeding charcoal to a small brazier. As we drew near, a little group of people approached her. A planter, accompanied by two black men dressed in rough cotton shirts and trousers, evidently his servants. One of them was holding the arm of a newly purchased female slave. Two other girls, naked but for small strips of cloth wrapped about their middles, were led by ropes around their necks. The planter bent and handed the old woman a coin. She turned and drew several short brass rods from the ground behind her, holding them up for the man's inspection. He studied them for a moment, picked out two, and straightened up. He handed the branding irons to one of his servants, who thrust the ends into the old woman's brazier. The other servant stepped behind the girl and pinioned her arms. The first man then pulled the irons from the fire and planted both together on the upper slope of her right breast. She shrieked, a high steam whistle sound loud enough to turn a few heads nearby. The irons pulled away, leaving the letters HB in raw pink flesh. I had stopped dead at the sight of this. Not realizing that I was no longer with them, the others had gone on. I turned round and round, looking vainly for any trace of Lawrence or Fergus. I never had any difficulty finding Jamie in crowds. His bright head was always visible above everyone else's. But Fergus was a small man, Murphy no taller, and Lawrence no more than middle height. Even Massali's yellow parasol was lost among the many others in the square. I turned away from the brazier with a shudder, hearing screams and whimpers behind me, but not wanting to look back. I hurried past several auction blocks, eyes averted, but then was slowed and finally stopped by a thickening of the crowd around me. The men and women blocking my way were listening to an auctioneer who was touting the virtues of a one-armed slave who stood naked on the block for inspection. He was a short man, but broadly built, with massive thighs and a strong chest. The missing arm had been crudely amputated above the elbow. Sweat dripped from the end of the stump.
"No good for field work, that's true," the auctioneer was admitting, "but a sound investment for breeding. Look at those legs."
He carried a long rattan cane, which he flicked against the slave's calves, then grinned fatly at the crowd.
"Will you give me a guarantee of virility?" the man standing behind me said with a distinct note of scepticism. "I had a buck 3 year past, big as a mule, and not a foal dropped on his account. Couldn't do a thing," the Juba girls said.
The crowd tittered at that, and the auctioneer pretended to be offended.
"Guarantee?" he said.
He wiped a hand theatrically over his jowls, gathering oily sweat on the palm.
"See for yourselves, O ye of little faith."
Bending slightly, he grasped the slave's penis and began to massage it vigorously. The man grunted in surprise and tried to draw back, but was prevented by the auctioneer's assistant, who clutched him firmly by his single arm. There was an outburst of laughter from the crowd, and a few scattered cheers as the soft black flesh hardened and began to swell. Some small thing inside me suddenly snapped. I heard it, distinctly. Outraged by the market, the branding, the nakedness, the crude talk and casual indignity, outraged most of all by my own presence here, I couldn't even think what I was doing, but began to do it all the same. I felt very oddly detached, as though I stood outside myself, watching. "Stop it," I said, very loudly, hardly recognizing my own voice. The auctioneer looked up, startled, and smiled ingratiatingly at me. He looked directly into my eyes with a knowing leer.
"Sound breeding stock, ma'am," he said. "Guaranteed, as you see." I folded my parasol, lowered it, and stabbed the pointed end of it as hard as I could into his fat stomach. He jerked back, eyes bulging in surprise. I yanked the parasol back and smashed it on his head, then dropped it and kicked him hard. Somewhere deep inside, I knew it would make no difference, wouldn't help in any way, would do nothing but harm. And yet I couldn't stand here consenting by silence. It wasn't for the branded girls, the man on the block, nor for any of them that I did it. It was for myself. There was a good deal of noise around me, and hands snatched at me, pulling me off the auctioneer. This worthy, recovered sufficiently from his initial shock, grinned nastily at me, took aim, and slapped the slave hard across the face. I looked around for reinforcements, and caught a quick glimpse of Fergus, face contorted in rage, lunging through the crowd toward the auctioneer. There was a shout, and several men turned in his direction. People began to push and shove. Someone tripped me, and I sat down hard on the stones. Through a haze of dust, I saw Murphy 6 feet away. With a resigned expression on his broad red face, he bent, detached his wooden leg, straightened up, and hopping gracefully forward, brought it down with great force on the auctioneer's head. A man tottered and fell as the crowd surged back, trying to get out of the way. Fergus, baffled of his prey, skidded to a halt by the fallen man and glared ferociously round. Lawrence, dark, grim and bulky, came striding through the crowd from the other direction, hand on the cane knife at his belt. I sat on the ground, shaken. I no longer felt detached. I felt sick and terrified, realizing that I had just committed an act of folly that was likely to result in Fergus, Lawrence, and Murphy being badly beaten, if nothing worse. And then Jamie was there.
"Stand up, Sassenach,"
he said quietly, stooping over me and giving me his hands. I managed it, knees shaking. I saw Rayburn's long moustache twitching at one side, MacLeod behind him, and realised that his Scots were with him. Then my knees gave way, but Jamie's arms held me up. "Do something," I said, in a choked voice into his chest. "Please, do something." He had. With his usual presence of mind, he had done the only thing that would quell the riot and prevent harm. He had bought the one-armed man. And, as the ironic result of my little outburst of sensibilities, I was now the appalled owner of a genuine male Guinea slave, one-armed, but in glowing health, and of guaranteed virility. I sighed, trying not to think of the man, presumably now somewhere under my feet, fed and, I hoped, clad. The papers of ownership, which I had refused even to touch, said that he was a full-blooded Gold Coast Negro, a Yoruba, sold by a French planter from Barbuda, one-armed, bearing a brand on the left shoulder of a fleur-de-lis and the initial A, and known by the name Téméraire, the Bold One. The papers didn't suggest what in the name of God I was to do with him. Jamie had finished looking at the papers his Masonic acquaintance had brought. They were very like the ones I had received for Téméraire, so far as I could see, from the rail of the ship. He handed them back with a bow of thanks, a slight frown on his face. The men exchanged a few more words and parted with another handshake.
"Is everyone aboard?" Jamie asked, stepping off the gangplank.
There was a light breeze. It fluttered the dark blue ribbon that tied back the thick tail of his hair.
"Aye, sir," said Mr. Warren, with a casual jerk of the head that passed for a salute in a merchant ship. "Shall we make sail?" "We shall, if you please. Thank you, Mr. Warren."
With a small bow, Jamie passed him and came to stand beside me.
"No,"
he said quietly. His face was calm, but I could feel the depths of his disappointment. Interviews the day before with the two men who dealt in white indentured labour at the slave market had provided no useful information. The Masonic planter had been a beacon of last-minute hope. There wasn't anything helpful to be said. I put my hand over his where it lay on the rail and squeezed lightly. Jamie looked down and gave me a faint smile. He took a deep breath
and straightened his shoulders, shrugging to settle his coat over them.
"I will. I've learned something, at least. That was a Mr. Villiers, who owns a large sugar plantation here. He bought 6 slaves from the captain of the ship Bruja 3 days ago, but none of them Ian."
3 days? I was startled. But the Bruja left Hispaniola more than 2 weeks ago. He nodded, rubbing his cheek. He had shaved, a necessity before making public inquiries, and his skin glowed fresh and ruddy above the snowy linen of his stock.
"She did, and she arrived here on Wednesday, 5 days ago."
"So she'd been somewhere else before coming to Barbados. Do we know where?" He shook his head.
"Villiers didn't ken. He said he'd spoken some time with the captain of the Bruja, and the man seemed very secretive about where he'd been and what he'd been doing. Villiers thought no great thing of it, knowing as the Bruja has a reputation as a crook ship, and seeing as how the captain was willing to sell the slaves for a good price. Still," he brightened slightly, "Villiers did show me the papers for the slaves he'd bought. You'll have seen those for your slave."
"I wish you wouldn't call him that," I said. "But yes, were the ones you saw the same?"
"Not quite. 3 of the papers gave no previous owner, though Villiers says they were none of them fresh from Africa. All of them have a few words of English at least. One listed a previous owner, but the name had been scratched out. I could not read it. The other 2 gave a Mrs. Abernathy of Rose Hall, Jamaica, as the previous owner."
"Jamaica? How far?"
"I dinna ken," he interrupted. "But Mr. Warren will know. It may be right. In any case, I think we must go to Jamaica next, if only to dispose of our cargo before we all die of disgust."
He wrinkled his long nose fastidiously, and I laughed. "You look like an anteater when you do that," I told him. The attempt to distract him was successful. The wide mouth curved upward slightly.
"Oh, aye? There's a beastie eats ants, is there?"
He did his best to respond to the teasing, turning his back on the Barbados docks. He leaned against the rail and smiled down at me.
"I shouldn't think they'd be very filling. I suppose it must eat a lot of them. They can't be any worse than haggis, after all."
I took a breath before going on and let it out quickly, coughing.
"God, what's that?"
The Artemis had by now slid free of the loading wharf and out into the harbour. As we came about into the wind, a deep, pungent smell struck the ship. A lower and more sinister note in the olfactory dockside symphony of dead barnacles, wet wood, fish, rotted seaweed, and the constant warm breath of the tropical vegetation on shore. I pressed my handkerchief hard over my nose and mouth.
"What is it?"
"We're passing the burning ground, mum, at the foot of the slave market," Maitland explained, overhearing my question.
He pointed toward the shore, where a plume of white smoke rose from behind a screen of bayberry bushes.
"They burn the bodies of the slaves who don't survive their passage from Africa," he explained. "First they unload the living cargo, and then, as the ship is swabbed out, the bodies are removed and thrown onto the pyre here to prevent sickness spreading into the town."
I looked at Jamie and found the same fear in his face that showed in my own.
"How often do they burn bodies?" I asked.
"Every day?" "Don't know, mum, but I don't think so. Maybe once a week," Maitland shrugged and went on about his duties.
"We have to look," I said. My voice sounded strange to my own ears, calm and clear. I didn't feel that way. Jamie had gone very pale. He had turned round again, and his eyes were fixed on the plume of smoke rising thick and white from behind the palm trees. His lips pressed tight then, and his jaw set hard.
"Aye," was all he said,
and turned to tell Mr. Warren to put about.
This ends Disc 28. Voyager, Disc 29.
The Keeper of the Flames, a wizened little creature of indistinguishable colour and accent, was vociferously shocked at the notion that a lady should enter the burning ground, but Jamie elbowed him brusquely aside. He didn't try to prevent me following him,
or turned to see that I did. He knew I wouldn't leave him alone here.